You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Exchange. And here's what's ahead today. A fragile rally as stocks try to recover from Friday's big sell-off. Traders handcuffed by the crude collapse and the coronavirus headlines. Will get you the very, very latest. Plus, presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg goes after the rich with his new tax plan, but he's a little more gentle about it than his peers. We'll look into those numbers. And Mark Zuckerberg says he wouldn't start a new company in Silicon Valley today, and that Facebook is about to tick everybody off, so to speak. We're going to get to all of that. But first, we get to Seema Modi. She's here with the numbers. Hey, Seema.
Great to see you in-house, Kelly Evans. Welcome back. Let's go straight to the markets following a very rough session overseas where Chinese stocks suffered their worst day since 2015, down nearly 8% after being closed for the Lunar New Year. Stocks here, they're rebounding, but nowhere close to erasing the losses from Friday. The Dow currently up 0.6%. Take a look at the story with oil now down about breaking below $55 a barrel. Energy producers really can catch a break. You have Marathon, Valero, Devon, all down between 1% and 4%. But finally, we're watching shares of Uber here. Wedbush adding it to the firm's best ideas list, saying the company has laid the groundwork for growth, especially in its Uber Eats operation. Stock up 2.6% and now up 26% so far this year. Kel?
All right, Seema, thank you. Let's move from stocks to bonds right now. It's been a wild few days for Treasuries. The 10-year yield falling and hitting the lowest level since early October. It's just over about 1.5%. Now about 1.53, as you can see there. Let's get to Rick Santelli. He's got much more on this from the CME. Hey, Rick.
Hi, Kelly. Welcome back. A one-year chart of tens gives you lots of information. Kelly referencing that October closing low of 153. We've been down as low as 151 intraday on Friday. And do remember, moving to the left of that chart, in September is the 146 cycle low yield close. Below that, it's 135 from July of both 2012 and 16 as the market continues to trade barely above historic levels. Look at a year to date of 10s minus 2s. You can see how much it shed from 35 basis points, 3 month to 10 year, the same scenario, trading at zero. Finally, if you look at 10s minus European bonds, you can see hovering under 200. This is the narrowest it's been in 2 years and 3 months. And finally, maybe the hottest chart of the day. This is June Fed Fund Futures, a one-week chart hovering just below 98.60. It is the first contract June 10th meeting that is over 50% chance of an easing. As a matter of fact, it's very close to 60%. Kelly, back to you.
We are going to pick it up right there. Rick, thank you so much, Mr. Santelli. Pressure is building, in fact, for the Fed to cut interest rates as the coronavirus spreads. First of all, does that make sense? Second of all, has the Fed already been easing? Let me bring in David Zervos. He's chief market strategist at Jefferies. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for being here. Thank you. Does it, by the way, make sense to you that we would be even talking about a Fed rate cut in the next couple of months because the coronavirus is going to have that much of a macro impact?
I mean, anything's possible. I think it's the market's maybe ahead of itself, but I think the key we think about, and I don't want to get too wonky, but we think about things in normal distributions, like, but there's just a fat tail to the downside in rates.
So there's more likelihood that we could see rate cuts.
And
why?
Let
me put it this way. Why is the 10-year at 1.5%, period?
Because really, like, a mean and a standard deviation don't mean exactly what they normally do in a normal time. It's not equal weight that we're going to go to a 3% two-year note or a 0% two-year note. The odds that we go to zero are just much, much higher. And I think that's a lot to do with the inflation outlook, the misses that we've had for so many years. And now you add in the coronavirus and a lot of uncertainty, people take out that insurance policy. And by the way, that's a very cheap insurance policy. Owning the front end of the yield curve on a levered basis is an extremely cheap insurance policy against your risk assets right now.
So what do you think? We've had this back and forth about stocks from different experts this week saying, you know, is now a good time to own them or not? What would you say?
I mean, I'm a risk parity guy, so I like my stocks, but I like my insurance policy, too. So I always have the risk parity combo, which is a levered front-end position in the yield curve, or two-year treasuries, five-year treasuries, and stocks. But I think you can make a pretty cogent argument for some caution on what's going on with this coronavirus. No. The reality is, Kelly, you're going to have as many guests on here. They can have a lot more expertise than me, but
Right. Nobody
really knows. The beauty is we do know about the Fed reaction function.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed is going to jump into action if something happens. And the the mechanism by which you're going to make money if they jump into action is owning the front end.
Right.
A lot more than the long end.
Right, exactly. And that's
what you can lever that up, futures markets, whatever you want, and basically have that in your back pocket against the risk assets and feel very comfortable going home every night long, I think.
Well, I was going to say, you think, but also it's been a lucrative scenario. One place that we're kind of watching for the transmission, I guess, is in oil prices. I mean, it's interesting that in the past, maybe you have to go back 10 years, we would have cheered low crude. Hey, that's great for the consumer. It's great for the economy.
Right.
Now we see this big drop in oil prices. When we try to figure out, you know, how does this move from a virus issue to, you know, really hurting the U.S. economy? Is that one way, do you think?
I mean, we know that the U.S. economy is a lot less sensitive to that oil price than it used to be. But I think it's very interesting position-wise. Forget about everything else. The market came in wanting to buy energy, wanting to sell the dollar, wanting to buy the euro, wanting to sell the 10-year note. A lot of the things that people were pushing on January 1 mm-hmm. and in December are really kind of failing, mm-hmm. at least the macro stuff. Forget about the individual stock stuff. So I think you have a lot of people, I think, that are on their back foot with regards to the macro situation. I don't think there was a lot of, I mean, I think most all of the research I read from the energy experts was, hey, this is the time to own it. So I think you've got a lot of bad positioning in the energy space as well. Maybe now you've cleared it. I mean, I think this is the worst start for oil
it's been
since
I think
1991.
Sure, we're down 18%
for January.
Right, right.
In the end, yes, you get something healthy with the consumer. Yes, you've still got a lot of oil producers here. I don't think the net is that big a deal. It is a big deal in EM. It is a big deal outside
markets.
The U.S.
Let me give you one final yes or no type thing. Rate cuts this year, then, do you think they happen?
Look, the odds of a rate cut are 10 times greater than the odds of a rate hike, maybe 20 times greater.
Justifiably?
Than a rate hike. And justifiably.
Okay.
And I also, I would say, you could make an argument. The Fed has done QE, even though they told you they didn't do QE. We should sort of be thankful that they screwed up in their own mind and did this, because in a way,
it
sort of feels like the market needs a little more tender, loving care than they gave it last year, which was just the 75
in
rate
cuts. Interesting. It's good to see you.
Great to see you.
Fresh from the Super Bowl, too. not Trump.
From Miami.
Not going to China anytime soon. Dave, thanks very much. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Dave Servos. As we mentioned, markets are losing steam today after Carnival confirmed that a former passenger did test positive with the coronavirus. Spread of that virus is impacting commodities hard, like we were just discussing. Copper is on pace for its 13th down day in a row, and crude is falling more than 2% and is down 17% this year. Jim Murillo has more right now. He's CNBC contributor and managing director at TJM Institutional Services. Jim, you were watching some of the key levels like $50 in crude. The fact that we came below that today, what does that tell you?
Well, it doesn't tell me anything yet. I think we have to close below it or have some follow through, because markets have tendencies to violate some of these levels. And you call them key levels. I'll even go a step further. I think these levels are huge. When you look at these are, you know, 5-year out charts we're looking about, and 50 is a level of huge significance. 250 is a level of huge significance in copper, too. Now, the negative side of the story is obviously, you know, well telegraphed. We see what it is. But on the positive side, too, we have Saudis talking about production cuts. We have China, you know, mumbling about huge stimulus coming in. And something that you guys just hit on is a Fed that I believe will hit the gas at any sign of a negative macroeconomic impact from this virus. So I think right now we see the push-pull. I want to see us build at this levels before I'm going to take a long shot in either one of them. But this is a pretty interesting time.
Okay. You know, Jim, just there were some out there who said it's kind of ironic that at a time when oil and gas prices are collapsing, that Tesla's soaring. I mean, if anything, it's looking more attractive to drive an old-fashioned car these days. But is there something, what is the price action in Tesla telling you right now? I mean, the stock is up 60% in a month.
Well, it's there was a time that Tesla did move, you know, inversely related to oil, but, you know, I mean, related to oil, not inversely. But that time is gone. Now we're just seeing a fear of missing out. We've seen price action like this in Bitcoin. We've seen price action like this in the banana taped to a wall that sold for $120,000. We've seen things trade. And I'm not saying Tesla's as crazy as that. I'm just saying that there's a lot of money chasing it right now, and I wouldn't even come close to touching it.
Tesla is the new banana taped to a wall. That's what I take away from that, Jim. No,
that's not what I said. I know.
No, we appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Good to see you as always.
Thank you. Good to see you too.
Here's what else is coming up today on the exchange.
Coming up, parts of China's economy grinding to a halt as the coronavirus shuts down cities. What could the ripple effect be if the country suffers from a massive slowdown? Plus, presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg releases his tax plan, and many are saying it's far from moderate. And the final FANG gets ready to report. This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back. As the coronavirus continues to spread, parts of China's economy have essentially come to a halt. Right now, at least 24 regions in China told businesses not to resume work before February 10th at the earliest. According to analysis by CNBC, those parts of China accounted for more than 80% of national GDP last year. 80% and nearly 90% of exports. Apple, Starbucks, Levi and McDonald's are just a few of the companies that have been forced to close some locations there. Question now is, what ripple effect could this have around the world? Joining me now is John Rutledge. He's chief investment officer at Safanat and a CNBC contributor. John, your first thoughts, how bad is the virus there? What are you hearing in terms of the impact it's having on, you know, what the Chinese think about their leadership? Just kind of your macro sense of things, because you do have some interesting stock picks here as well I want to get to.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a terrible tragedy, and unfortunately, nobody knows what's going to happen with it. Inside China, people are quite scared, and you have individual cities with 10 million people that are being quarantined. Now, that's if, from the rest of the world's position, the strong arm nature of the Chinese government makes that actually positive, because they're more able to contain it. But what we haven't seen yet is any humanitarian issue photos with governments clamping down, people trying to get out of town, et cetera. But people are very scared. People are trying to stay home. People are not allowed out of their houses for more than once a day to get essential foods. So it's a real scary situation.
Sure. And the Chinese market today down 7% when it reopened. A lot of the individual stocks were down 10%. You think there are some opportunities there. What do you see?
Well, first of all, there's a trading limit. That market, individual stock price, cannot fall more than 10% or it won't trade.
Right.
Which means that 7% is probably 17% if you actually knew what the trading prices would be for those stocks.
Wow.
So I think the big story is that we've got uncertainty, obviously, but we've got a lot of fear and ignorance going on at the same time. Rightly so. Ignorance, we just don't know. We, most American investors, don't know all that much about China or Chinese stocks or Chinese accounting or Chinese policy. So when people get scared, they pucker up and pull their money closer to home. So capital outflows from China is the big issue. The RMB has been dropping against the dollar big time. It's more than 7
and
now.
And you've warned that the decline in their currency could hurt the businesses that have the U.S. debt in dollars, which we've spoken about. Let me just ask you very specifically, because you do say you think Luckin Coffee is an interesting opportunity. It's the big rival to Starbucks in the country there. You know, what makes you feel comfortable? Is the price action that bad? I mean, has the stock been allowed to fall that much that you think it is something that investors here in the U.S. could or should own?
Well, most investors shouldn't go anywhere near it because they don't know anything about it.
Exactly.
Starbucks, when people push Starbucks price down because they close their Chinese stores, we should buy the stock because we understand that company more.
Mm-hmm.
Luckin, however, is a very successful, fast-growing competitor of Starbucks inside China. Both of them have closed their stores. So you're going to have very negative near-term results for both, but we ought to think also there's fundamentals out there. However long this lasts, it'll one day be over. And when it's over, what have we got? We've got 1.5 billion people, an enormous consumer market with a growing middle class. We'll have growth rates that will be much lower this year, but back up to, you know, 4, 5, 6, some number bigger than ours the year after that. And they've got a central bank that is shoveling liquidity in the market today big time. And we've got a strong-arm government that can do things to stop crises that our government can't really do. So I think what that says is for every dollar worth of a stock you own,
mm-hmm.
only 1 or 2 cents of that dollar reflect its performance this year.
Sure.
The other 98 or 99 is later than that. The duration of the stock market free cash flow is more than 40 years.
All
so
right.
If I see prices going down 10% in an hour or a day, then that's an interesting situation. And sometimes you can actually buy that. And then in the afternoon, people get unafraid for an hour or two, and you can actually trade it.
Yeah, the 40-year time horizon could see a lot of changes. But you're bullish, I guess we should say, on China for now, not, all of those concerns notwithstanding. John, it's good to see you.
For nibbling, yeah.
Nibbling.
For nibbling purposes.
Nibbling or sipping.
Buying later.
Sipping on luck and coffee.
Yeah.
John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Rutledge from Safanad. Coming up, from Bill Murray in a Jeep to Google's memory aid, we're going to take a look at the most impactful ads from the Super Bowl this year. We're also going to look at Michael Bloomberg's, who's revealed his tax plan and targets the wealthy and corporations in it. We'll have the details and the impact it could have on your investments ahead. A reminder, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in two. Welcome back to The Exchange. Here are some of the movers this hour. Shares of Gilead are jumping. The company is working with China to test its investigational antiviral drug as a treatment for people with coronavirus. Gilead underperformed the markets last year, dropping 10%. There's its rebound today. Nike shares are leading the Dow higher following a bullish call at JP Morgan. The analyst there putting the stock on its focus list as a growth play, saying investors should buy the coronavirus dip. For Nike, we're going to be speaking with the analyst behind that call ahead on Power Lunch. And take a look at shares of Tesla. The stock is soaring more than 16% now. 17%. Oh, my goodness. It's crossed above $760 after only crossing $700 for the first time a couple of hours ago. Ty, it's up 75% this year. I'm with Tyler Matheson to also unveil the winner of the stock draft today on Power, Ty, which is
and
related.
You chose to come back on this highlight of a day right here.
For this
last
purpose.
Night, they had that cheesy Vince Lombardi trophy, but we have right here the 2019-2020 stock draft trophy. Winner, Noah Syndergaard of the New York
Good
Mets.
Good job, Noah.
Why? Because he had the smarts to pick Tesla, which was up 100-some percent during the period of the stock draft. He finished with the highest returns ever in the history of our stock draft, I think up something like 55%. Coming in second place was the prior year's winner, Nick Lowry, formerly of the Kansas City Chiefs.
Another athlete.
I think he'll take the concession prize, the consolation prize.
He was only
winning the Super Bowl for his Chiefs.
That's right.
We will be talking to Noah Syndergaard on our hour at 2 o'clock on Power Lunch to congratulate him. Obviously, if the baseball thing doesn't work out, he's got a future.
Boy, does he. He better come back this year. And it was only this with this Tesla move this past week that really propelled him
really
to victory.
Lifted him over
it's
the top.
Been shocking. All right, Ty, we'll see
Welcome
you.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to have you.
I'll see you soon. Let's get to Sue Herrera now for our news update. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Kelly. Welcome back. Good to see you. Here's what's happening at this hour, everyone. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meeting with the Ugandan president at the presidential palace. Later, he met with Sudan's leader, and they have begun the process of normalization. Israel has long courted African support. Palestinian President Abbas says his government will continue its boycott of the U.S. as a response to the White House plan aimed at ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He spoke during the Council of Ministers meeting in Ramallah. 30-year-old Hannah Romhild, the woman that police say drove through two checkpoints outside of President Trump's Palm Beach resort, appearing in court this morning. Her attorney says she has a history of mental illness and was not taking her medication at the time of her arrest. And a hockey mascot accused of assault is cleared. The Philadelphia Flyers' Gritty was accused of punching a 13-year-old boy in the back in November. His father complained to police, who launched an investigation. Gritty was exonerated by the police this morning. You're up to date. That's the news update this hour. Kel, back to you.
All the mascot news you need to know.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks very much. Here's what else is ahead on The Exchange.
Ahead, cruising to an earnings slowdown. Bloomberg's bold tax plan. Vegans aren't happy about Burger King's Impossible Whopper. And airlines are scrambling to enforce the coronavirus travel restrictions. It's all coming up on The Exchange.
Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. I missed it so much.
And
guys,
we missed you.
Yes,
welcome back.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Here to break down the headlines are Seema Modi, Robert Frank, and Kate Rogers. And welcome to all of you. Let's talk about these cruise ship headlines first today and what's going on with the coronavirus. Carnival has confirmed that one of its passengers did test positive. That is sending all the cruise line stocks lower. This as the second person spreading of the virus was reported in the U.S. today. today as well. Royal Caribbean had already said it's suspending three scheduled voyages for its only ship based in China. It's warned investors it'll take an earnings hit that could grow as the travel restrictions continue. They report earnings, I think, tomorrow morning.
Yes.
Seema, the cruise ship industry may be one that's easiest to quantify the impact, but what does it tell us about how this thing is impacting the economy and other sectors more broadly?
Well, I think out of all the travel sectors, cruise lines are watched very closely when there are these health scares because these massive vessels just pack in thousands of passengers. So they often say the risk of infection is much higher.
Now, the norovirus that always seems
exactly,
to be going
around. Exactly, or even E. coli, right? The rate of infection is much higher. Faster because there's just so many people. Now, in regards to this Diamond Princess cruise line, what's interesting is that the passenger who sailed the ship disembarked in Hong Kong and then developed symptoms 6 days later. So that's a big scare here as we try to understand the epidemiology behind coronavirus and how fast a patient can show symptoms. That's a little scary.
So basically,
you could be interacting with someone.
Right. So they started to show symptoms 6 days after getting off the ship. So they... The question is, where did they contract it, or what kind of interaction was there?
He boarded in Japan.
Exactly, Yokohama.
So he either got in Japan or got it long before that, before he even got to Japan, and got it in China. Do we know?
Are there cases in Japan right now?
There are cases in Japan, yes. But that's why Japanese authorities are using this quarantine as a way to try to really assess the patients that, or passengers that could potentially have interfaced or interacted with this one passenger.
Yeah.
Well, what does this do to the cruise industry moving forward? Like we talk about, you know, with a McDonald's or a Starbucks, like those are missed opportunities for customers to come in and patronize the restaurants. Obviously, they're going to be hit. But once we know more about coronavirus, like, will people pull back on going on cruises for exactly the point you brought up right off the top? It's thousands of people on these ships. I mean, does that scare people off if and when this does get contained?
Yeah, and Kelly, that is the number one question we'll have to ask Richard Fain, CEO of Royal Caribbean, who'll be joining us on this program tomorrow, fresh off of earnings, to get a sense of, because both Royal and Carnival have already lowered their guidance because of the suspended sailings. But the key question is the impact on longer-term bookings.
Yeah.
Are Americans saying, you know what, why should we even book a cruise ship or cruise for the summer or fall because of the risk of infection?
But you know what? I canceled a honeymoon we didn't cancel a honeymoon, but we didn't go where we were going to go because of Zika. Mm-hmm. And then nothing ever. I'm not saying that this is clearly more serious, but it's frustrating because all of a sudden there's these huge panics and reactions, and then all of a sudden one day it disappears. Mm. I'm still harboring some resentment. Anyway, next up, let's talk about WeWork, which is hiring a new CEO with a real estate background today. Sandeep Mathrani will join the company after serving as the CEO of Brookfield Properties Retail Group. And he's got a tall order. WeWork's latest numbers showed that loss of $1.25 billion in the third quarter. That was more than they even made in revenue, which was less than $1 billion. The WeWork occupancy rate has slid back to 2017 levels. So, Robert, this seems to confirm what all the bears have been saying about WeWork, that it's, quote unquote, just a real estate company.
Yeah. So most people knew that already. And so I think by admitting it, number one, yes, it is a real estate company. It's not a tech company. It's not a lifestyle brand. It is a real estate company. Now, Mathrani is very good at A, turnarounds, and B, leases. And what WeWork is right now is an underwater lease company. They have a lot of leases that they rented at very high rates that they're going to have to rent out sublease at low rates. And how are you going to renegotiate those? And that's why I think he's going to be the best choice that they have, whether they can do anything better than cash flow positive by 2023, which is the current projection, is a big question.
The idea that they were some kind of nouveau tech platform that deserved a high multiple, that balloon had already been pricked.
Yeah.
So in a way, the valuation's already been reset to the reality that it's a real estate company, and maybe they should be encouraged that someone who knows how to run that well can come in and
And not just that, but it highlights how commoditized this space is. So he ran a company called Industrious, which is Brookfield's own entry into the workspace co-working model. So there are a lot of other competitors. Once you take away the free beer and the ping pong and all the other stuff that they had, basically this is a very competitive space. It's commoditized. And he's proof of that because he's already run one of these companies.
One of its potential rivals. They're also based in New York, as I understand, so he would have to commute from Miami or something
I think he's going to move. He's going to move from Miami.
Well, I'm only thinking about it because of the next story, which is we're talking about some Facebook here. Mark Zuckerberg had just said that the Bay Area is not where he would start a company anymore. He was at a tech conference in Utah saying, quote, "I like the Bay Area. I'm not super negative on it, but I do think on balance, if I was starting from scratch now, I wouldn't pick it." He also went on to say that Facebook's support of free speech and its strong encryption, which he's made a big stand about lately, will, quote, piss off a lot of people. First, though, on the Silicon Valley issue, Bay Area has some real challenges. I mean, not least the high cost of living, the crime problems in San Francisco and so forth. I mean, he didn't say where he would build, I guess, but it didn't sound like it was necessarily going to attract the brightest.
Yeah, you think about when he started Facebook and that idea that, you know, we all saw the movie. So when he moved out to Silicon Valley, he needed to do that because that's where the staff was. That's where the engineers were. That's where the software guys were. And at that time, that's the only place that they were, that you could find enough of them. The Sean Parker was out there, all the mentors he wanted. Nowadays, you can go to Austin, you can go to Chicago, you can go to Boston, you can go to Nashville.
So you don't think it's an indictment of Silicon Valley or San Francisco, that region, so much as a positive message about what's happening across the whole country now?
I do. It is that, and it is San Francisco, which has completely mismanaged the growth and the concerns about inequality and the ability to just build more housing. I mean, they've restricted housing, so you can't build more, and that's not going to change anytime soon.
That is definitely part of the issue. It's also a testament to what all of these major tech companies have done since he started Facebook, and Facebook included. Social networking is a huge way to reach new people and find potential talent and build companies, and you don't necessarily have to be right there on the ground.
Platform to now.
So I think it's kind of a two-pronged statement, right? Like, San Francisco is a mess. This needs to be cleared up, but also because of what all of these companies have done, you don't have to be here to do it.
And what about what he said about upsetting people, Seema? I mean, it's obvious no one liked or really rallied behind him in this message about free speech and so forth. The encryption issue may be a little bit separate from that.
I mean, is it a cry for help or sort of self-reflective? He's got a little philosophical in this speech. In a way, I kind of enjoyed it. He was speaking off cuff. But we'll have to see if this is perhaps a sign of where he wants to take the message for Facebook in 2020.
Right. Fair enough. Quickly, Burger King is looking to have a way with its proposed class action lawsuit over Impossible Whoppers, saying they never promised that these Whoppers were vegan, guys, nor did they promise to cook them a particular way. This is because the plaintiff is arguing that Burger King duped him into believing that and is now seeking damages on behalf of all the consumers in the U.S. who have bought one.
I'll just say this. If you are an extremely strict vegan, I believe you're often questioning preparation methods. We have several people in my family who are vegans by choice, and because of some dietary restrictions that they have, they always ask how things are prepared. And I think that because Burger King never advertised these as vegan, that's on you as the customer to ask how this is being prepared. The Impossible Whopper and Impossible Brands also said these are for flexitarians, so these aren't necessarily marketed toward vegan. We're not saying that they are 100%. If they're prepared a certain way, they would fall under that umbrella, but these are being prepared on the same grill. I mean, it's an issue. I'm not sure how far this gets.
So I agree that it's not a lawsuit, because if you look at the fine print and the little asterisk down there, it says it's prepared in open kitchen. And then if you look at the sub to that, it says it could be prepared
in a microwave. So yes,
the legal waiver is there. But I was surprised, and I think most people are surprised, to learn that their plant-based burger is being cooked on the same grill as the meat-based products, and that they can commingle or whatever they
share
do on the grill.
Oil.
There,
well, it's the juices, right? They're all flowing in between. But
why can't you just have a separate part of the grill that's like blocked out of the world? I'm going to cook the plant-based stuff here. Why can't you do that?
Well, you raise an interesting point. If that's what the customer ultimately demands, and you're right, I don't think the class action suit necessarily is going to move forward here. If the consumer wants them to not commingle, what's the expense now that restaurants
in the oven, you can bake it, but that's gross.
Yeah, right. You can microwave it. So if you do want it to be
yum.
Vegan, you can ask for it to be microwaved. But what they're saying, the whole flexitarian thing, I think that gets at the heart of this, is that people want options, and I don't know that everyone's adhering to a strict diet.
I'm just saying options cost money. Don't you think for these restaurants, these kitchens?
100%.
Yeah, if they have to now
change
double
the kitchen.
Right, the grill space or whatever.
And that gets to the heart of, is it worth it at all to add this to the menu if you're a franchisee? Like, everyone's waiting for McDonald's to do this.
Right.
They've just undergone this massive transformation. Will they want to also change up their kitchen to do this?
Because who takes that cost? Is the franchisee or the actual
operator?
Well,
a lot of times they'll co-invest. Like, the experience of the future with McDonald's
is
you can co-mingle. Yeah, it's a co-investment between the franchisees and the parent company, but it still comes at a cost to them, and they want to make sure it pays off.
Fascinating. So. All right, before we go, the Super Bowl is over now, but the brands are hoping the buzz continues, and USA is out with its ad meter results from last night. They said that Bill Murray Jeep Groundhog Day commercial takes the cake. It scored a 7 out of 10. That makes it the winner in terms of, I guess, most impactful. Right behind it is Hyundai's Smart Park ad with the Boston accent.
That was good.
It was great.
But it's written like there's no other way to read that.
No, but that was good.
Thank you. Then you have ads by Google, Doritos, and Rocket Mortgage. The worst three in terms of impact, Michael Bloomberg's campaign ad, Pop-Tarts Fix the Pretzel ad and President Trump's criminal justice reform campaign ad. So I guess the politics didn't rate that well in terms
shocking.
Of...
Shocking. People prefer Dorito ads to less than...
Yeah, like, can we have one
mean?
Night
yeah,
without the
I know. Exactly.
Like, it is
exactly.
The Super Bowl.
But I think the biggest victory, and I didn't watch the game, I watched a little bit of the commercials, but getting Bill Murray...
Did you intentionally try to miss the game in order
yes,
to catch
Yes, absolutely. Because that's my wife and daughters were only interested in the commercials and the halftime show.
Halftime,
so that's,
yeah.
That's what I watched. But to, the victory here was, for me, to get Bill Murray to do a commercial. Mm. I mean, to get him to do a great movie is hard enough. Like, he maybe will show up, he maybe doesn't. But I was, look, he did it for the money, yes. But I was just surprised that he's even in a Jeep commercial. Hats off to them.
Apparently, you can't even find him. He doesn't have an agent.
Right.
He doesn't have an email
address.
It's the weird 800
number that you call.
He has a 1-800 number that you have to use to call him, and maybe he will call you back. So I think, to your point, I was just surprised to see Bill Murray out there and
yeah.
in a Super Bowl commercial.
Now I need to know the whole backstory of how this ad came
yeah.
to be.
Yeah, whether they how they got
but
him there.
My only point, too, is everyone this morning is talking about it as the Bill Murray commercial. They're not saying it's the Jeep ad. I mean,
right.
do these things really matter? Are they really worth the money? It's good for Bill Murray's career, but is it going to change?
Are they going to sell more Jeeps?
It didn't sink in because for Smart Park. Did I do that right? I'm from New Jersey.
Yeah, that was good.
Thank you.
You both did it well.
I don't even remember what car that was for.
Yeah.
I just remember John Krasinski was there.
Right.
Yeah.
Good for the actors' careers. And the ads are so overproduced, and there's so much hype. And I'd be hard-pressed. I know it doesn't work like this, but to think about an ad that was really impactful. What do you guys, the Google ad?
And by the way, every year,
that was endearing.
And every year after the Super Bowl, we hear the same two things. The ads that worked had celebrities and humor.
Right.
Every year, it's the same thing.
But you have to wonder why, obviously, President Trump and Mike Bloomberg, we know who they're trying to reach. Everyone into...
Well, that was an ego thing between the two of them.
That
it was just for Bloomberg to show, if you're going to be here, I can be there too.
I've got the money.
And that was all it was
about. Like
they knew
it
no one
work.
Would care.
Yeah, well, but not only do people not care, they didn't like it. So.
Right.
And we
yeah.
will get the ratings numbers for the Super Bowl next hour in Power Lunch. Looking forward to that. Thank you all. Appreciate it. Seema Modi, Robert Frank, and Kate Rogers. Speaking of Google, shares of Alphabet climbing more than 15% over the past 3 months. The trillion-dollar club member is also the last of the FANG names to report earnings this earnings season. We'll tell you the key numbers to watch for right after this. Welcome back. Alphabet is the last of the FANG names to report earnings this season. Will the company keep its membership in the trillion-dollar club? Josh Lipton joins me now with the key numbers to watch after the bell. Hey, Josh.
So, Kelly, here's what the street is expecting. Q4 EPS of $12.53 on revenue of $46.94 billion. Now, that suggests a 20% jump on the top line as analysts think ad spending stayed strong in the quarter. Alphabet shares solidly in the green so far this year. They're up about 15% since that announcement in early December that Sundar Pichai was taken over as CEO, with founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin stepping down as CEO and president. So looking ahead, what changes could that mean for the search giant? Well, Morgan Stanley details three ways that the company can improve shareholder friendliness, in their words, more consistent disclosure, particularly for assets like YouTube and that cloud computing business, guidance on operating expenses and capital returns, saying buybacks and dividends would increase the attraction of owning this name. Kelly, back to you.
Josh, although people have been pushing for more transparency on YouTube, for instance, for a long time, and look at the shares, they just continue to perform.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Listen, Kelly, I talk to CFO Ruth Porat every quarter for years now. I always do ask for more disclosure there on YouTube, Cloud, Waymo. I haven't gotten very far yet. I think one reason there's more interest this time around could be, listen, Sundar Pichai taking over here at CEO. I know there's financial analysts who are now wondering, does that change at all how this company engages with investors? And one thing they're wondering is, does that mean more improved, consistent disclosure? Maybe we'll find out after the bell, Kelly.
Yeah, and I'll be very curious in the cloud after Microsoft's big numbers last week, too. A lot to look for later. Josh, thanks very much. Josh Lipton in San Francisco. Meantime, Mike Bloomberg unveiling his tax plan, and it'll very likely hike his personal tax bill. We'll have all the details for you next. Welcome back. We've got them already, the official viewership numbers for the Super Bowl. Julia Boorstin, how do they look?
Well, Fox reporting that the Super Bowl was viewed by 102 million viewers across both TV and digital. So this is inclusive of all properties, both TV and streaming. Now, for comparison, this compares to last year. The Super Bowl was viewed by fewer people by 100.7 million viewers. So that's a slightly smaller number. But last year, we knew that there was a TV audience of 98.2 million viewers. We don't know how many of the 102 million people watched on television. So we're going to be breaking down those results as we get more details from Fox and the NFL later in the day. But it looks like a slight increase from last year.
But back, Julia, quickly, you do think we'll learn what the breakdown was? That's the
anticipation? We do expect to learn what the breakdown is. If you look at all of the viewing, both TV and digital, Fox says that this was the 10th most watched Super Bowl in history, but we are waiting for that additional detail, which we do expect later in
the day. I've got some thoughts about the scoreboard, too. But, Julia, thanks very much. Julia Boorstin. Presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg unveiling his tax plan. It aims to raise $5 trillion and would likely increase his own tax bill. Robert Frank is back with those details for us.
Well, Kelly, it is a $5 trillion plan, and it's more than 50% higher than Joe Biden's, but less than a quarter of the size of that of Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. Now, it has three basic parts. First, he would hike the top income tax rate to 44.6%. That's for income over $5 million. He would raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. And this is the biggest change. He would tax capital gains the same as ordinary income for those making more than $1 million, which means that if you have a capital gain, that's you sell an asset, a stock, a house or a company, the top rate would go from 20% to 44.6%. If you're in California, New York, that rate would be over 56%. Now, he also would end the step up in basis. That's when unrealized gains go untaxed after you die. He would also broaden the estate tax to apply to more Americans. And he would get rid of carried interest, which lots of people have said they would get rid of, but nobody has.
The carried interest being aimed at the private equity industry,
correct,
among others.
And, yeah.
Robert, stay with us. Let's drill down a little bit more on Bloomberg's plan and how it stacks up against other proposals. Ben White is here. He's chief economic correspondent in Politico and a CNBC contributor. Welcome, sir.
Welcome back, Kelly.
Thank you. So the interesting thing about Mike Bloomberg's plan is that he doesn't have the big headline raising plans of what to spend the money on, does
right.
he? I mean, what is his, putting aside what this, the impact of some of this, like the 56% rate on some capital gains,
sure.
what does he want to do with the $5 trillion?
Right. Well, he's talked about infrastructure, he's talked about education, he's talked about healthcare to some degree, though not Medicare for all. He wants to do a lot of different things to kind
environmental
of
programs.
Environmental
yeah.
programs. I'm sure there'd be some, you know, gun buybacks and gun violence stuff, because that's a big issue for him. So he does want to raise revenue. I think a lot of this is you cannot be a candidate for the Democratic nomination without having a wealth increase, a tax increase on the wealthy. Now, he doesn't do a wealth tax like Sanders and Warren do,
right.
which would try to assess all assets in a very difficult way. But if you want to get the nomination, you have to be in the game of I'm for raising taxes
and that's
on the wealthy.
The irony, Robert, as has been pointed out, is that this would seem like such an extreme move if it weren't in comparison to Medicare for All,
precisely.
Green New Deal, and the things that cost multiple trillions.
If a Democratic candidate had put out this plan 4 years ago, 8 years ago, where you're calling for a 10% increase in government spending, $5 trillion in additional spending, where the capital gains rate, which has been sacred for the Republican Party and for many of the Democrats for ages, had come out with this, they would say, they would call it socialism.
Right.
But
radical.
In this context, where we're talking about people who want a wealth tax, which Bloomberg says is unconstitutional, he would also have to pay a lot of money for it, it suddenly looks moderate.
Yeah.
And by any other election cycle, it's not.
Yeah, and I think it makes things complicated for Biden here, which is the real Bloomberg story, is what is his impact on Biden going forward? He's now essentially Bloomberg's a little bit to the right of Warren and Sanders, but now a little bit to the left of Biden. Gets into the Super Tuesday states, he would naturally take votes away from a centrist like Joe Biden. Does that mean more gravitate to Sanders and Warren?
When we had Howard Schultz toying right. with the idea of running, people said, you're going to be a spoiler, you're going to ruin it for the Democratic Party. And he basically ended up saying, forget it, I'm out.
Yeah.
Why aren't people treating Bloomberg the same way, as a spoiler for the traditional candidates, who is buying his way into the election and making some of their sort of core beliefs look hypocritical?
Yeah, I think some of them are treating him that way and are worried about him being a spoiler particularly for somebody like Biden. I mean, there is a lot of nervousness in the Democratic Party, particularly we're on the Iowa caucus day.
Sure.
And Bernie
Schultz,
Sanders,
was he thinking of running as an independent?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's where it pulls away. It's
but
one thing to have a Schultz type guy in the tent.
Right.
Where you're getting those votes. Another thing to say, look, the only people you detract from would be the
party. Here's my point. Only if Bloomberg wins, right? If it's Iowa or in the run-up, if he and Biden split the centrist vote
exactly.
so that a Bernie Sanders,
yeah,
for example, becomes
the
candidate.
That's where
the
spoiler factor comes in.
That's
yeah.
right.
And again, if that's what voters
spoiler.
Want, that's what voters want. But
sure.
if they partition off what voters want just enough, does it actually create, you know, the outcome that they
right.
get?
Right. And remember, before Bloomberg entered, his people said the only way he enters is if Biden drops out
right.
or looks
right.
like it's not going to happen.
Right.
And yet Biden's still in the lead in
yeah.
the polls and Bloomberg has joined. So my question is, what
Why?
Calculus
right.
changed there? Or did ego take over?
I think ego took over. I think the idea that, you know, he has a ton of money that he'd like to spend and the message that he'd like to get out. And
yep.
I do think that he maybe ultimately thinks he doesn't get this nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody like Biden does. And then he has a huge arsenal to go after President Donald Trump in the general election to assist in the Democratic nominee. But problem is, in the process, he may wind up making the Democratic nominee somebody he doesn't want.
Exactly.
One thing we know, he won't win today.
Well,
in Iowa.
Not being on the ballot makes it a little
that
difficult
hurts.
To win. Yeah.
Guys, thank you both.
Thank
Ben
you,
White, Robert Frank, we appreciate it. The coronavirus has sickened more than 17,000 people, and the onus is now on the airlines to uphold the administration's sweeping new travel restrictions. We're going to talk about what that means for both carriers and travelers right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. A host of new White House travel restrictions are aimed at stemming the coronavirus outbreak, and they're leaving airlines scrambling to comply. The TSA is now requiring the airlines screen all U.S.-bound passengers to see if they've recently visited China before boarding. Let's put that into some perspective. More than 135 million people traveled here by air last year. That's more than 370,000 travelers a day. For more on the effect here, CNBC.com airline reporter Leslie Josephs joins me. Leslie, this is a lot of pressure on the airlines, isn't it, to try to figure out how to handle this?
It is a lot of pressure on the airlines, and they didn't have many days to comply. So we found out about this on Friday afternoon, and the restrictions went into effect at 5 p.m. Eastern on Sunday. So that's not a lot of time. And we've also heard from Delta, United, and American already cutting flights. United's will take effect in a couple days. But they didn't have a lot of time to go through this. And we keep talking China. But this is all international travelers. So what the United States government wants to know is whether travelers have been in China. That's U.S. citizens, permanent residents, and foreigners.
And how are they going about finding that out?
The TSA is telling airlines, question the travelers before they board. They're not going to be allowed to board if they're a foreigner and not.
Can they just lie? I mean, I hate to say it.
That's the problem.
But, yeah.
I mean, it's like a very poor situation, and a lot of it relies on the honor system. The TSA also told them to, like, look through their passports. This is what a Chinese entry or exit stamp
would
look like.
Which
would take a while. Airlines are telling travelers to get to the airport early. And we're not just talking China, so we're talking Paris. We're talking Mexico City and
Buenos Aires. All international travelers.
Right.
Wow.
Exactly.
So they, especially by the time these go into effect, a lot of people will say, look, the horse is out of the barn. I mean, should the airlines themselves have been more proactive as soon as word of this broke? I mean, a lot of people say, look, this is the day and age where it's better safe than sorry. You might take a hit to earnings or something, but it's much better than inadvertently spreading this virus worldwide.
Well, the airlines did act pretty quickly in cutting those flights, but also the demand was down. So you didn't have the business trips that you had before. I mean, we've heard from Apple to Ford, Kraft. I mean, like, name it, like, runs the gamut.
Right.
So you're not getting that corporate travel spend that's there. So they kind of cut it as a commercial decision before. But they did act pretty quickly. Now that they have to sort of enforce, they're like the first line of defense for these U.S. government restrictions, and now other countries are putting in similar, they have to tell their gate agents and sometimes contractors in foreign countries
right.
that they work with for security, checking passengers in and things like that, that you need to question passengers before
and
they board.
It's a lot. And this follows, so they have now idled aircraft that they use for these China routes, which they clearly don't need at the moment. This after, of course, they've been dealing with the loss of Boeing jets for a year or so now. How much of a hit are we expecting them to take in this quarter because of this inactivity?
Well, it's not clear yet, but I mean, Asia had been sort of a weaker spot compared with some of the other regions. I mean, domestic travel has been very strong because of the trade tensions and things like that. There had been some softness in Asia. So we expect that to sort of build. I mean, we're only at February 3rd, and we're not going to hear from them again until April, but they're likely to update in terms of, like, load factors and how many people are actually getting on the plane pretty soon.
Are you hearing anything from them in terms of when this normalizes? We just don't know, do we?
They don't know. I mean, and they're taking also direction from the United States government. They don't really have a choice. I mean,
yeah.
the government says you need to check these passengers, and they pretty much have to comply.
Wow. Well, it's good for, like you said, for travelers to know. And we've seen the impact with the stock selling off as they try to make financial sense of this. Leslie, thanks very
much. Thank you. Welcome back.
Leslie Joseph, thank you for CNBC.com. You can read her story on our website as well. And in case you missed it, I'll be answering your questions on CNBC's Instagram account all day today. Follow at CNBC to submit your queries because the responses will come just after the next show.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.